Captain, that thing is dangerous. Put it down. I snapped out that last in a tone of pure authority, one I'd gotten used to when working with Molly and various folks I'd met through the Paranet. She froze in her tracks and arched an eyebrow at me, but only for a split second. Then she smoothly replaced the box and stepped away from it. I see. You were holding it when we dragged you in here. You wouldn't let it go, in fact. Well, I said. No. Which, I take it, explains what you were doing at the station. Well, I said. Yes. Quite a coincidence, she said. I shook my head. In my experience, when there's a Knight of the Cross around, there's no such thing as a coincidence. She frowned at that. It's been a very long time since I've been to confession. Nearly a century, in fact. I'm not aware that the Almighty owes me any favors. Mysterious ways, I said smugly. She laughed. I take it they've used that line on you before. Constantly, I said. A good man, she said. You're lucky to have him as a friend. I frowned and said quietly, Yeah, I am. I shook my head. When's the parley? Noon tomorrow, she nodded at the mantle. Can you tell me what's in there? Options, I said, if the parley fails. Out with it, Dresden, she said. I shook my head. She put a fist on one hip. Why not? Gave my word. She considered that for a moment. Then she nodded once and said, As you wish. Get some more rest. You'll need it. Then she prowled over to my love seat, sank wearily down into it, and without another word, curled up under a blanket. She was apparently asleep seconds later. I thought about getting up and checking out Guard's case, maybe calling Michael and Murphy, but the weariness that suddenly settled on my limbs made all of that sound impossibly difficult. So I settled in a little more comfortably and found sleep coming swiftly to me as well. The last thing I noticed before I dropped off was that under all the blankets, I was entirely undressed. And I was clean. Chapter 27 I still don't see why I can't go, Molly said, folding her arms crossly. You know how you told me how much you hate it when your parents quote scripture at you to answer your questions? I asked her. Yeah. I'm not going to do that. Because I don't know this one well enough to get the quote right. She rolled her eyes. But it's something about the best way to defeat temptation is to avoid it. Oh, please, Molly said. Actually, he's right, Thomas said, passing over my duster. Seriously, I know temptation. Molly gave my brother a sidelong look and blushed faintly. Stop that, I told him. Thomas shrugged. Can't help it, I'm hungry. I wound up jumping rooftop to rooftop for half an hour, dodging a bunch of 3-foot-tall lunatics with bows and arrows. Elves, I murmured. Someone on Summer's team was calling in backup, too. Interesting. I wonder which side tipped the scales first. You're welcome, Thomas said. Hey, Molly snapped. Can we get back on topic? I know how to handle myself, Harry. This is supposed to be a talk, not a fight. I sighed, turning to her. We were talking to each other in the carpenter's kitchen, while everyone else geared up in the workshop. Thomas had sneaked in the front door of the house to pass my staff and coat back to me after his evening of decoy work. Grasshopper, I said. Think who we're going to be talking to. Nicodemus, the head of the Denarians, she said. The man who tried to kill my father and my teacher, and did his best to put a demon inside my little brother's head. I blinked. How did you know about the usual eavesdropping on Mom and Dad? She replied impatiently. The point being that I'm not going to be tempted to pick up one of his coins, Harry. I'm not talking about you being tempted, kid, I said. I'm worried about him. Given everything that's going on, I'd rather not wave a Knight of the Cross's brushed with darkness daughter under his nose. We're trying to avoid a huge fight, not find new reasons to start one. Molly gave me a steady stare. Hey, I said, how's that homework I gave you coming? She stared some more. She'd learned that from Charity, so she was pretty good at it. I'd gotten Charity's stare plenty, though, so I'd been inoculated. She turned in silence and stalked out of the kitchen. Thomas snorted quietly. What? I asked him. You really think you're going to avoid a fight? I think I'm not going to hand them any of Michael's family as hostages, I said. Nicodemus has got something up his sleeve. As I spoke, I made sure the little holdout knife in its leather sheath was still secured up mine. The only question is, who's going to start the music and where? Where's the meeting? I shrugged. Neither party knows. Kincaid and the Archive are picking a neutral spot. They've left my place early this morning. They're going to call. But I doubt they'll start it this soon. My money says that Nicodemus will want something in exchange for Marcone. That's when he'll make his move. At the exchange, Thomas asked. I nodded. Try to grab the whole tamale. Uh-huh, Thomas said. Speaking of, I came by your place after I was done playing tag with assassin midgets last night. Got a whiff of perfume on the doorway and checked through the window on the south side of the house. He gave me a sly grin. About fucking time, man. I frowned at him. What? The grin faded.
You mean you still didn't?
Oh, empty night, Harry. What did you see? I saw you talking to a woman who had already taken half her clothes off for you, man. Oh, come on, I said. Thomas, it wasn't like that. She was just getting clean. I gave him the short version of the previous evening. Thomas gave me a look of his own. Then he thwapped me gently upside the head. Hey, I said. Harry, he said. You were sleeping for hours. She had plenty of time to get clean. You think she sat around for all that time because she wasn't tired just yet? You think she didn't plan on you seeing her? I opened my mouth to answer and left it that way. For that matter, she could have settled down behind the couch, where you couldn't have seen her if you did wake up, Thomas continued. Not right by the fire, where she made what I thought was quite a nice little picture for you. I didn't think she... He stared at me. You didn't make a move. She's... Lucio is my commanding officer, man. We work together. Thomas rolled his eyes. That's a 21st century attitude, man. She's a 19th century girl. She doesn't draw the lines the same way you and I do. But I never thought it. I can't believe this, Thomas said. Tell me you aren't that stupid. Stupid? I demanded. Yeah, he said bluntly. Stupid. If she offered, and you turned her down because you had a reason you didn't want to, that's one thing. Never realizing what she was talking about, though. That's just pathetic. She never said, my brother threw up his hands, what does a woman need to do, Harry? Rip her clothes off, throw herself on top of you, and shimmy while screaming, do me, baby? He shook his head. Sometimes you're a friggin' idiot. I spread my hands. She just went to sleep, man. Because she was being thoughtful of you, you knob. She didn't want to come on too strong and make you uncomfortable, especially given that she's older and more experienced than you are, and your commanding officer to boot. She didn't want to make you feel pressured, so she left you plenty of room to turn her down gracefully. He rolled his eyes. Read between the lines once in a while, man. I sighed. I've never been hit on by a woman 150 years older than me, I said lamely. Try to use your brain around women once in a while, instead of just your juju stick. Thomas tossed me my staff. I caught it. Everyone's a critic. My brother purloined an apple from the basket on the island in the kitchen on his way to the door, glanced over his shoulder and said, Moron, thank God Nicodemus is a man. He left, and I stood there for a second being annoyed at him. I mean, sure, he was probably right, but that only made it more annoying, not less. Something else he was right about. Anastasia had looked simply amazing in front of that fire. I hadn't really thought of her in terms of her first name before, just as Lucio or the Captain or Captain Lucio. Come to think of it, she'd been out of the dating game for even longer than me. Could be that she hadn't exactly been brimming with self-confidence last night either. The situation bore thinking upon. Later. For now, there was intrigue and inevitable betrayal afoot, and I had to focus. I headed out to the workshop. The day was brighter than the one before, but the cloud cover still hadn't gone. It had stopped snowing, though wind kicked up enough powder to make it hard to tell. A check of the mirror had revealed that the tip of my nose, the tops of my ears, and the highest parts of my cheeks were rough and ruddy from exposure to cold and my brush with hypothermia. They looked like they suffered from a heavy sunburn. Added to my raccoon eyes, I thought them quite charming. No wonder Lucio had thrown herself at me with such wanton abandon. Damn it, Harry, focus, focus. Danger is afoot. I opened the door to the workshop just as Michael folded his arms and said, I still don't see why I can't go. Because we're trying to avoid a fight, Lucio said calmly. And an atmosphere of nervous fear is not going to foster a good environment for a peaceful exchange. I'm not afraid of them, Michael said. No, Lucio said, smiling faintly, but they're afraid of you. In any case, Guard said, neither the Church nor the Knights are signatories of the Accords. Not to put it too bluntly, Sir Michael, but this is quite literally none of your business.
You don't know these people, Michael said quietly, not the way I do.
I do, I said quietly, at least in some ways. Michael turned to give me a steady, searching look.
Maybe, he said quietly. Do you think I should stay away?
I didn't answer him immediately. Guard watched me from where she sat on the edge of her cot, now dressed and upright, if not precisely healthy-looking. Hendricks sat at the workbench again, although he was sharpening a knife this time. Weapons nuts are always fiddling with their gear. Murphy, seated down the bench from Hendricks, was cleaning her gun. She wasn't moving her wounded arm much, though she apparently had full use of that hand. Sonya loomed in a corner near the workbench, patiently working some kind of leather polish into Esperacius's scabbard.
I don't think this is where they'll try to stick in the knife, I said quietly.
I turned my eyes to Lucio.
I also don't think it would be stupid to have a couple of knights on standby in case I'm wrong.
Lucio's head rocked back a little.
No reason not to hedge our bets, I told her quietly. These people don't play nice like the Unseelie Fae or the Red Court. I've seen them in action, Captain.
She pursed her lips and her eyes never wavered from my face.
All right, Warden, she said finally. It's your city. I did not agree to this, Guard said, rising, her expression dark.
Oh, deal with it, Blondie, I told her. Beggars and choosers. The White Council is backing you up on this one, but don't start thinking it's because we work for you, or your boss.
I'm going to be there too, Murphy said quietly without looking up from her gun. Not just somewhere nearby. There, in the room.
Pretty much everyone there said no, or some variant of it at that point, except for Hendricks, who didn't talk a lot, and me, who knew better.
Murphy put her gun back together during the protests, and loaded it in the silence afterward.
If you people want to have your plots and your shadowy wars in private, she said, you should take them to Antarctica or somewhere. Or you could do this in New York or Boise, and this isn't any of my business. But you aren't in any of those places. You're in Chicago, and when things get out of hand, it's the people I'm sworn to protect who are endangered.
She rose, and though she was the shortest person in the room, she wasn't looking up at anyone.
I'm going to be there as a moderating influence with your cooperation. Or we can do it the other way. Your choice. But I know a lot of cops who are sick and tired of this supernatural bullshit sneaking up on us.
She directed a level gaze around the room. She hadn't put the gun away.
I smiled at her, just a little. Guard looked at me and said, Dresden? I shrugged and shook my head sadly.
What? Once we gave them the vote, it went totally out of control.
You're a pig, Harry, Murphy growled.
But a pig smart enough to bow to the inevitable, I said. I looked at Guard and said, far as I'm concerned, she's got a legitimate interest. I'll back it.
Warden, Lucio said in a warning tone, may I speak to you? I walked over to her.
She can't possibly know, Lucio said quietly, the kind of grief she could be letting herself in for.
She can, I replied as quietly. She's been through more than most wardens, Captain. And she sure as hell covered my back enough times to have earned the right to make up her own mind.
Lucio frowned at me for a moment, and then turned to face Murphy.
Sergeant, she said quietly, this could expose you to a considerable degree of risk. Are you sure?
If it were your town, Murphy said, your job, your duty, Could you stand around with your fingers in your ears?
Lucio nodded slowly and then inclined her head.
Besides, Murphy said, half smiling as she put her gun in her shoulder holster, it's not as if I'm leaving you people much choice.
I like her, Sonya rumbled in his deep, half-swallowed accent. She's so tiny and fierce. I don't suppose she knows how to...
Sonya,
Michael said, his voice very firm. We have talked about this. The dark-skinned Russian sighed and shrugged.
It could not hurt to ask.
Sonya!
He lifted both hands in a gesture of surrender, grinning, and fell silent. The door to the house banged shut, and running footsteps crunched through the snow. Molly opened the door to the workshop and said,
Harry, Kincaid's on the phone. He's got the location for the meeting.
Kincaid? Murphy said in a rather sharp voice.
Yeah, didn't I mention that?
I asked her, my tone perfectly innocent as I headed for the door.
He showed up last night.
Her eyes narrowed. We'll talk.
Tiny, Sonya rumbled to Michael, clenching a demonstrative fist, but fierce.
Chapter 28. People think that nothing can possibly happen in the middle of a big city, say Chicago, without lots of witnesses seeing everything that happened. What most people don't really understand is that there are two reasons why that just ain't so. The first being that humans in general make lousy witnesses. Take something fairly innocuous, like a minor traffic accident at a busy pedestrian intersection. Beep, beep, crunch. Followed by a lot of shouting and arm waving. Line up everyone at that intersection and ask them what happened. Every single one of them will give you a slightly different story. Some of them will have seen the whole thing, start to finish. Some of them will have seen only the aftermath. Some of them will have seen only one of the cars. Some of them will tell you, with perfect assurance, that they saw both cars from start to finish, including such details as the expressions on the driver's faces and changes in vehicle acceleration, despite the fact that they would have to be performing simultaneous feats of bilocation, levitation, and telepathy to have done so. Most people will be honest and incorrect. Honest incorrectness isn't the same thing as lying, but it amounts to the same thing when you're talking about witnesses to a specific event. A relative minority will limit themselves to reporting what they actually saw, not things that they have filled in by assumption or memories contaminated by too much exposure to other points of view. Of that relative minority, even fewer will be the kind of person who, by natural inclination or possibly training, has the capacity for noticing and retaining a large amount of detail in a limited amount of time. The point being that once events pass into memory, they already have a tendency to begin to become muddled and cloudy. It can be more of an art form than a science to gain an accurate picture of what transpired based upon eyewitness descriptions. And that's for a matter of relative unimportance, purely a matter of fallible intellect with no deep personal or emotional issues involved. Throw emotions into the mix, and mild confusion turns into utter havoc. Take that same fender bender, make it an accident between a carload of neo-skinhead types and some gangbangers at a busy crosswalk in a Southside neighborhood, and you've got the kind of situation that kicks off riots. No matter what happens, you probably aren't going to be able to get a straight story out of anyone afterward. In fact, you might be hard-pressed to get any story out of anyone. Once human emotions get tossed into the mix, everything is up for grabs. The second reason things go unnoticed in the middle of a big city is pretty simple. Walls. Walls block line of sight. Let me rephrase that. Walls block line of involvement. The human animal is oriented around a sense of sight. Things aren't real until we see them. Seeing is believing, right? Which is also why there are illusionists. They can make us see things that aren't real, and it seems amazing. If a human being actually sees something bad happening, there's a better chance that he or she will act and get involved than if the sense of sight isn't involved. History illustrates it. Oh, sure, Allied governments heard reports of Nazi death camps in World War II, but that was a far cry from when the first troops actually saw the imprisoned Jews as they liberated the camps. Hearst had known it before that.
You furnish the pictures, and I'll furnish the war.
And according to some, he did. Conversely, if you don't see something happening, it isn't as real. You can hear reports of tragedies, but they don't hit you the way they would if you were standing there in the ruins. Nowhere has as many walls as big cities, and walls keep you from seeing things. They help make things less real. Sure, maybe you hear loud, sharp noises outside some nights, but it's easy to tell yourself that those aren't gunshots, that there's no need to call the police, no need to even worry. It's probably just a car backfiring. Sure, or a kid with fireworks. There might be a loud wailing or screams coming from the apartment upstairs, but you don't know that the drunken neighbor is beating his wife with a rolling pin again. It's not really any of your business, and they're always fighting, and the man is scary besides. Yeah, you know that there are cars coming and going at all hours from your neighbor's place, and that the crowd there isn't exactly the most upright-looking bunch, but you haven't seen him dealing drugs, not even to the kids you see going over there sometimes. It's easier and safer to shut the door, be quiet, and turn up the TV. We're ostriches, and the whole world is sand. Newbies, who are just learning about the world of wizards and the unpleasant side of the supernatural, always think there's this huge conspiracy to hide it from everyone. There isn't. There's no need for one, beyond preventing actual parades down Main Street. Hell's bells, from where I'm standing, it's a miracle anyone ever notices. Which is why I was fairly sure that our parlay with the Archive and the Denarians in the Shed Aquarium was going to go unremarked. Oh, sure, it was right in the middle of town, within a stone's throw of the Field Museum and within sight of Soldier Field, but given the weather, there wasn't going to be a whole lot of foot traffic, and the aquarium was in its off-season. There might be a handful of people there caring for the animals, but I felt confident that Kincaid would find a way to convince them to be somewhere else. Murphy had rented a car, since hers was so busted up. The past few days of snow had seen a load of accidents, and there weren't any compact cars left, so she wound up with a silver caddy the size of a yacht, and I'd called shotgun. Hendricks and Guard rode in the back seat. Guard had gotten to the car under her own power, though she had been moving carefully. Lucio sat beside Guard with her slender staff and her silver rapier resting on the floorboards between her feet. Though my own staff was a lot longer and had to slant back between the front seats and past Guard's head, up into the rear window well. City work crews were still laboring to clear roads and access to critical facilities. An off-season tourist attraction was not high on anyone's priority list. For that matter, the Field Museum had been closed due to the weather, which meant that there really weren't any functioning public buildings for several hundred yards in any direction. That could be a problem. Michael's white truck wasn't going to be able to get anywhere close without being spotted, which meant that he and Sonya were going to be 2, maybe 3 minutes away from helping, provided they could be signaled at all. That was practically the other side of the world, where a violent confrontation is concerned. On the other hand, it also meant that the bad guys weren't going to be able to bring in any help without being spotted either. Provided they were driving cars, of course. Glass half full, Harry, glass half full. There was no profit to be had in the fight. Not yet, anyway. Whatever Nicodemus was after, he'd have to make his demands before he had a chance to double-cross us out of whatever he wanted us to bring him. Besides, given what I'd seen of the Archive in action, he'd be freaking insane to try anything where she was officiating. She didn't brook slights to her authority lightly. The nearest street had been cleared by city trucks, but none of the parking lots had been done, and the excess snow from the streets formed small mountains on either side of the road. "Looks like we're gonna have to walk in," Murphy said quietly. "Keep circling. They keep the animals here year-round," I said quietly. "And they've got to be fed every day. The staff will have broken a trail in somewhere." "Perhaps they let the exhibits go hungry during the storm," Guard suggested. "Few would venture into this for the sake of their paychecks." "You don't do oceanography for the money," I said. "And you sure as hell don't take up working with dolphins and whales for the vast paycheck in the company car." I shook my head. "They love them. Someone's gone in every day. They'll at least have broken a foot trail." "There," Murphy said, pointing. Sure enough, someone had hacked a narrow opening into the mounded snow at the side of the road and dug out a footpath on the other side. Murph had to park at the side of the road with the doors of the rental car just an inch from the snow walls. If someone came along going too fast, given the condition the streets were in, the caddy was going to get smashed, but it wasn't like she had a lot of choice. We all piled out of the driver's side of the car into the wan light of early afternoon. Lucio and I paused to put on our gray warden's cloaks. Cloaks look cool and everything, but they don't go well with cars. Lucio buckled on a finely tooled leather belt that held a sword on her left hip and a Colt on her right. My .44 was back in my duster pocket, and the weight of both the coat and the gun felt greatly comforting. The wind caught my coat and the cloak both, and almost knocked me over until I got them gathered in close to my body again and under control. Hendrix, stolid and huge in his dark, sensible London fog winter coat, went by me with a small smile on his face. Hendrix took point, and the rest of us followed him through what could only generously be called a trail. Instead of the snow being up to our chests, on the trail we sank only to our knees. It was a long, cold slog up to the aquarium, and then around the entire building, where the snow had piled up to truly impressive depths in the lee of the wind on the south side of the structure. Wind, hustling in over the frozen lake, felt like it had come straight from outer space, and everyone but guard hunched up miserably against it. The trail led us to an employee's door in the side of the building, which proved to have had the lock housing on its frame covered in duct tape, leaving it open. Hendrix opened the door, and I stuck my head in and took a quick look around. The building was dark beneath its smothering blanket of snow, except for a few dim nightlights set low on the walls. I didn't see anyone, but I took an extra moment or two to extend my senses into the building, searching for any lurking presences or hostile magics. Nothing. But a little paranoia never hurts in a situation like this. Captain, I said quietly, what do you think? Lucio moved up beside me and studied the hall beyond the doorway, her dark eyes flickering alertly back and forth. It seems clear. I nodded, said, excuse me, and went through the door in a burst of raging anticlimax. I stomped the snow off my boots and jeans as best I could as the others came in behind me. I moved farther down the hall, straining to sense anyone approaching, which meant that I heard the soft scuff of deliberately obtrusive footsteps 2 or 3 seconds before Kincaid rounded the far corner. He was dressed in his customary black clothing again, fatigue pants and a hunting jacket over body armor, and he had enough guns strapped to his body to outfit a terrorist cell, or a Texan nuclear family. He gave his chin a sharp little lift toward me by way of greeting. This way, please. His eyes focused past me and his voice died in mid-courtesy. He stared over my shoulder for a second, sighed, and then told me, "She can't be here." I felt my eyebrows rising. The corners of my mouth went along for the ride. I leaned in a little to Kincaid and murmured, "You tell her." His gaze went from Murphy to me. A less charitable man than I might have called his expression sour. He drummed one thumb on the handle of his sidearm and asked, "She threatened to call in the constabulary?" She's got this funny thing where she takes her oath to protect the city and citizens of Chicago seriously. It's as if her promises mean something to her. Kincaid grimaced. I'll have to clear it with the archive. No Murphy, no meeting, I said. Tell her I said that. The assassin grunted. You can tell her yourself. He led me through the halls of the shed to the oceanarium. It was probably the most popular exhibit there. A great big old semicircular building containing the largest indoor aquatic exhibits in the world. Its outer ring of exhibits sported a number of absolutely huge pools containing millions of gallons of water and a number of dolphins and those little white whales whose names I can never remember. The same as the caviar. Beluga whales. There were rocks and trees built up around the outsides of the pools, complete with moss and plants and everything to make it look like the Pacific Northwest. Although I was fairly sure that the bleacher seats where the audience could marvel at whales and dolphins, who would show up and do their usual daily health inspections for their trainers to the sound of applause, weren't indigenous to the Pacific Northwest. I think those were actually Floridian in origin. A pair of dolphins swept by us in the water, flicking their heads out as they went to get a look at us. One of them made a chittering sound that wasn't very melodic. The other twitched his tail and splashed a little water our way, all in good fun. They weren't the attractive, flipper kind of dolphins. They were regular dolphins that aren't as pretty and don't get cast on television. Maybe they just refused to sell out and see a plastic surgeon. I held a fist up to them. Represent. Kincaid scanned the bleachers, frowning. She's supposed to be sitting here.
Damn it.
I sighed and circled back toward the stairs to the lower level. She might be the archive, but she's still a kid, Kincaid. He frowned and looked at me.
So?
So, kids like cute. He blinked at me.
Cute?
Come on. I led him downstairs. On the lower level of the Oceanarium, there's an inner ring of exhibits, too, containing both penguins and, wait for it, sea otters. I mean, come on, sea otters. They open abalone with rocks while floating on their backs. How much cuter does it get than small, fuzzy, floating, playful tool users with big, soft, brown eyes? We found Ivy standing in front of one of the sea otter habitats, dressed much more warmly and practically this time, and carrying a small backpack. She was watching two otters chase each other around the habitat and smiling. Kincaid stopped in his tracks when he saw that. Just to see what he'd do, I tried to step past him. He shot me a look like he'd murder me if I tried to interrupt her, and my opinion of him went up a notch. I eased back and waited, no skin off my teeth to let the girl watch the otters for a minute. It had been hard, sometimes, when I was a kid, after my magic had started coming in. I'd felt weird and different, alone. It had gradually distanced me from the other kids. But Ivy had never had the luxury of belonging, even temporarily. From what I understood, she'd been in the archive since she was born. Fully aware and stuffed full of knowledge from the time she'd opened her eyes, I couldn't even imagine how hideous that would be. Hell, the more I learned as I got older, the more I wished I were ignorant again. Well, innocent, anyway. I remembered what it was like, at least. Ivy had never been innocent. I could let her smile at sea otters, you bet. A shadow moved behind me, and I willed myself not to be creeped out. I turned and saw the two dolphins from the tank above cruise by, observing us again. The huge tanks contained observation windows running the whole length of the second-level gallery, so you could see the cute things on one side and ogle the homely dolphins and the caviar whales on the other. From down here, you could also see the far wall of the big tank, which was a curved wall of glass that faced the open waters of Lake Michigan. That always seemed a little sadistic to me. I mean, here were animals whom nature had equipped to roam the open vastness of the deep blue sea, being kept in a mere 3 million gallons or so of water. Bad enough to do that to them without giving them a window seat onto all that open water, too. Or maybe it wasn't. I hear it kind of sucks to be a whale or a dolphin in the open ocean these days, given the state of the fishing industry. I guess they're looking at a can one way or another, I muttered. Hmm? Kincaid said. Nothing. Ivy let out her breath in a satisfied sigh a moment later as the otters vanished into their den. Then she turned toward us and blinked. Oh, she said. Her cheeks colored slightly, and for a moment she looked very much like a young girl. Oh. She smoothed wrinkles that didn't exist in her trousers, nodded at Kincaid, and said, Yes? Kincaid nodded toward me. Local law enforcement wants a representative present to observe. Dresden supporting it. She took that in for a moment. Sergeant Murphy? Yes, I said. I see, she frowned. When she spoke, her tone was careful, as if she were considering each word before she spoke it. Speaking as arbiter, I have no objection, provided both parties involved in the parley give their assent. Right, Kincaid said. He turned and started walking. I nodded to Ivy, who returned the gesture. Then I turned and hurried to catch up to Kincaid. So? I asked him as we climbed the stairs. So, he said. Let's go talk to Nicodemus. Kincaid led me down the way from the Oceanarium and out to the main entry hall. It's another grandiose collection of shining stone floor and towering Corinthian columns arranged around a huge tank the size of a roller rink. It's full of salt water and coral and seaweed and all kinds of tropical fish. Sometimes there's a diver with a microphone built into his or her mask, feeding the little sharks and fish and talking to gawking tourists. Diffused light floods in through an enormous triangular-paneled cupola overhead. The recent snow had blackened the panes of the cupola and drifted up over most of the glass front doors, so that the only light in the room came from the little colored lights in the huge tank. Fish glided through the tank like wraiths, the odd light casting sinister shades over their scales, and their shadows drifted disembodied over the walls of the room, magnified by the distance in the glass walls of the aquarium. It was eerie as hell. One of the shadows drew my attention as some instinct picked out a strong, subtle sense of menace about it. It took me a couple of seconds to realize that this particular shadow disturbed me because it was human, and moving in perfect gliding pace around the wall behind the shadow of one of the tank's small but genuine sharks, even though the man who cast the shadow was standing perfectly still. Nicodemus turned from contemplating the fish swimming in the tank so that I could see the outline of his profile against the softly colored lights. His teeth gleamed orange-red in the light of the nearest underwater lamp. I stopped myself from taking an involuntary step back, but just barely. "It's a metaphor," he said quietly. He had a good voice, mellow and surprisingly deep. "Look at them. Swimming, eating, mating, hunting, killing, fleeing, hiding, each to its nature. All of them so different, so alien to one another. Their world, in constant motion, always changing, always threatening, challenging." He moved one arm, sweeping it in a wider gesture. "They cannot know how fragile it is, or that they are constantly surrounded by beings with the power to destroy their world and kill them all with a twitch of a finger. It is no fault of theirs, of course," Nicodemus shrugged. "They are simply limited. Very, very limited. Hello, Dresden."
"You're playing the creepy vibe a little hard," I said. "Might as well go for broke. Put on a black top hat and pipe in some organ music."
He laughed quietly. It didn't sound evil as much as it did rich and supremely confident.
"There's some irregularity with the meeting, I take it."
Kincaid glanced at me and nodded.
"Local law enforcement wishes a representative to be present," I said.
Nicodemus's head tilted.
"Really? Who?"
"Does it matter?" Kincaid asked, his tone bored. "The archive is willing to permit it, if you have no objections." Nicodemus turned all the way around, finally. I couldn't see his expression, just his outline against the tank. His shadow, meanwhile, kept circling the room behind the shark.
"Two conditions," he said.
"Go on," Kincaid said.
"First, that the representative be unarmed, and that the archive guarantee his neutrality in the absence of factors that conflict with matters of law enforcement duty."
Kincaid glanced at me. Murphy wouldn't like the unarmed part, but she'd do it. If nothing else, she wouldn't want to back down in front of me. Or maybe Kincaid. But I had to wonder, what was Nicodemus's problem with an armed cop? Guns did not bother the man, not even a little. Why that stipulation? I nodded at Kincaid.
"Excellent," Nicodemus said. "Second," he walked forward, each footstep sounding clearly upon the marble floors, until we could see him in the nearest floor lights. He was a man of medium height and build, his features handsome, strong, his eyes dark and intelligent. Hints of silver graced his immaculate hair, though he was holding up pretty well for a man of 2000. He wore a black silk shirt, dark pants, and what could have been mistaken for a gray western tie at his throat. It wasn't. It was an old, old rope from the same field as his coin.
"Second," he said. "I want 5 minutes alone with Dresden."
"No offense, Nick," I said, "but that's about 5 minutes longer than I want to spend with you."
"Exactly," he replied, smiling. It was the kind of smile you see at country clubs and in boardrooms and on crocodiles. "There's never really a good opportunity for us to have a civilized conversation. I'm seizing the chance for a chat." He gestured at the building around us. "Sans demolition, if you think you can refrain." I scowled at him.
"Mr. Arcleone," Kincaid said, "are you offering a peace bond? If so, the archive will hold you to it."
"I offer no such thing," Nicodemus said, without looking away from me. "Dresden would count it as worthless coin, and his is the only opinion that really matters in this particular situation."
He spread his hands.
A talk, Dresden. 5 minutes. I assure you, if I wished to do you harm, even the hellhound's reputation... He paused deliberately to glance at Kincaid with naked contempt in his gaze. Would not make me hesitate for an instant. I would have killed you already. Kincaid gave Nicodemus a chill little smile, and the air boiled with potential violence. I held up a hand and said quietly,
Easy there, Wild Bill. I'll talk with him, and we'll have our sit-down, all nice and civilized.
Kincaid glanced at me and arched a shaggy, dark gold eyebrow.
You sure?
I shrugged a shoulder. All right, he said. I'll be back in 5 minutes. He paused, then added, If either of you initiates violence outside of the strictures of a formal duel, you'll be in violation of the accords. In addition, you will have offered an insult to the reputation and integrity of the Archive, which I will take personal action to amend. The wintry chill in his blue eyes was mostly for Nicodemus, but I got some of it too. Kincaid meant it, and I'd seen him in action before. He was one of the scarier people I knew, the more so because he went about matters with ruthless practicality, unhindered by personal ego or the pride one often encountered in the supernatural set. Kincaid wouldn't care if he looked into my eyes as he killed me, if that was what he set out to do. He'd be just as happy to put a bullet through my head from 1,000 meters away, or wire a bomb to my car and read about my death on the internet the next morning. Whatever got the job done. That kind of attitude doesn't help you when it comes to finding flashy or dramatic ways to do away with your enemies, but what it lacks in aesthetics, it makes up in economy. Marcone, whom this whole mess was about, worked the same way, and it had taken him far. You crossed such men at extreme peril. Nicodemus let out another quiet, charming laugh. He didn't look impressed by Kincaid. Maybe that was a good thing. Too much pride can kill a man. On the other hand, from what I'd seen of him, maybe Nicodemus really was that tough.
Run along, hellhound, Nicodemus said. Your mistress's honor is quite safe. He drew an X on his chest. Cross my heart.
Maybe it was an inside reference. Kincaid's eyes flashed with something hot and furious before they went glacial again. He nodded to me, then precisely the same way to Nicodemus, and left. I'm pretty sure the room didn't actually become darker and scarier and more threatening when I was left alone with the most dangerous man I'd ever crossed. But it sure felt that way. Nicodemus turned that toothy predator's smile to me as his shadow began to glide around the walls of the entry hall, circling me like a shark.
So, Harry, he said, walking closer, what shall we talk about?
Chapter 29.
You're the one who wanted a conversation, I said, and don't call me Harry. My friends call me Harry.
He turned one hand palm up. And who says I cannot be your friend?
That would be me, Nick, I say. Here, I'll show you, I enunciated. You can't be my friend.
If I am to call you Dresden, it is only fair that you should call me Arc Leon.
Arc Leon? I asked. As in, seeking whom he may devour? Kind of pretentious, isn't it?
For half of a second, the smile turned into something almost genuine. For a godless heathen, you are entirely too familiar with scripture. You know that I can kill you, do you not?
We'd make a mess, I said. And who knows? I might get lucky.
Really, really, really lucky. Nicodemus moved a hand in acknowledgement. But, barring luck,
yeah,
I said.
And you offer such insouciance regardless?
Habit, I said. It doesn't make you special or anything, believe me.
Oh, I picked the right coin for you.
He started to walk in a slow circle around me, the way you might a car at the dealership. There are rumors that a certain warden has been flinging hellfire at his foes. How do you like it?
I'd like it better if it came in pine fresh and new car instead of only rotting egg, I said.
Nicodemus completed his circuit of me and arched an eyebrow. You haven't taken up the coin.
I would, but it's in my piggy bank, I said. And I can't break the piggy, obviously. He's too cute.
Lashiel's shadow must be slipping, Nicodemus said, shaking his head. It has had years to reason with you, and still you refuse our gifts.
What with the curly little tail and the big sad brown eyes, I said, as if he hadn't said anything. One of his heels hit the ground with unnecessary force, and he stopped walking. He inhaled through his nose and out again.
Definitely the proper coin for you. He folded his hands carefully behind his back. Dresden, you have a skewed image of us. We were operating at cross purposes the first time we met, and you probably learned everything you know about us from Carpenter and his cohorts. The church has always had excellent propaganda.
Actually, the murder, torture, and destruction you and your people perpetrated spoke pretty loudly all by themselves.
Nicodemus rolled his eyes. Dresden, please. You have done all of those things at one time or another. Poor Cassius told me all about what you did to him in the hotel room.
Gosh, I said, grinning. If someone had walked in on us in the middle of that sentence, would my face be red or what?
He stared at me for a second, and the emotion and expression drained out of his features like dewdrops vanishing under a desert sunrise. What was left behind was little more than desolation. Harry Dresden, he said, so softly that I could barely make it out, I admire your defiance of greater powers than your own. I always have. But tempus fugit, for all of us. I blinked. For all of us? What the hell did you mean by that? Have you not seen the signs around you? Nicodemus asked. Beings acting against their natures, creatures behaving in ways that they should not, the old conventions and customs being cast aside. I narrowed my eyes at him. You're talking about the Black Council. He tilted his head slightly to one side. Then his mouth twitched at the corner and he nodded his head very slightly. They move in shadows, manipulate puppets. Some of them may be on your council, yes? As good a name as any.
Stop playing innocent, I spat at him. I saw the leftovers of the Black Council attack on Arctis Tor. I know what hellfire smells like. One of yours was in on it.
Nicodemus blinked.
Then he surged forward, fast, so fast that by the time I'd registered that he was moving, my back had already hit the wall that had been 20 feet behind me. He hadn't been trying to hurt me. If he had, the back of my head would have splattered open. He just pinned me there against the wall with one hand on my throat, tighter and harder than a steel vice.
What? He demanded, his voice still a whisper. His eyes, though, were very wide, both sets of them.
A second set, these glowing faintly green, had opened just above his eyebrows. Andurials, I presumed.
Quack, I said.
Garl!
His arm quivered for a second, and then he lowered his eyelids until they were almost closed. A moment later, he very, very slowly relaxed his arm, allowing me to breathe again. My throat burned, but air came in, and I wheezed for a second or two while he stepped back from me. I glared up at him and debated slamming him through one of those Corinthian columns by way of objecting to being manhandled, but I decided that I didn't want to piss him off. Nicodemus's lips moved, but an entirely different voice issued from them, something musical, lyrical, and androgynous.
At least it has some survival instinct.
Nicodemus shook his head as if buzzed by a mosquito and said, Dresden, speak.
I'm not your friend, I said, my voice rough. I'm not your damn dog, either. Conversation over.
I took a few steps to one side so that I could move around him without taking my eyes off him and started to leave.
Dresden, Nicodemus said, stop.
I kept walking. I was almost out of the room before he spoke again, resignation in his tone.
Please.
I paused, without turning around.
I reacted inappropriately, especially for this venue. I apologize.
Huh, I said, and looked over my shoulder. Now I wish I had brought Michael. He'd have fainted.
Your friend and his brethren are tools of an organization with its own agenda. And they always have been, Nicodemus said. But that's not the issue here.
No, I said. The issue is Marcone. Nicodemus waved a hand. Marcone is an immediate matter. There are long-term issues in play. I turned to face him and sighed. I think you're probably full of crap. But okay, I'll bite. What long-term issues?
Those surrounding the activities of your Black Council, Nicodemus said. Are you certain you saw evidence of hellfire in use at the site of the attack on Arctis Tor?
Yes. I didn't add the word dummy. Who says I ain't diplomatic?
Nicodemus's fingers flexed into the shape of claws and then relaxed again. He pursed his lips.
Interesting. Then the only question is if the contamination is among standing members of our order, or...
He let the thought trail off and glanced at me, lifting an eyebrow. I followed the logic to the only other people in possession of any of the coins.
Someone in the church, I whispered with a sick feeling in my stomach.
Historically speaking, we get about half of the coins back that way, Nicodemus noted.
What would you say if I told you that you and I might have a great many common interests in the future?
I wouldn't say much of anything, I said. I'd be too busy laughing in your face.
Nicodemus shook his head. Short-sighted. You can't afford that. Come with me for a week and see if you feel the same way when you're done.
Even assuming I was stupid enough to go anywhere with you for an hour, much less a week, I saw how you treated Cassius. I'm not real eager to slide my nameplate onto his office door.
He didn't adjust to the times, Nicodemus replied with a shrug. I wouldn't have been doing him any favors by coddling him. We live in a dangerous world, Dresden. One adapts and thrives, or one dies. Living on the largesse of others is nothing but parasitism. I respected Cassius too much to let him devolve to that.
Gosh, you're chatty, I said. You were right. This is so much fun. It's almost like
a horrible thought hit me. Nicodemus was many things, but he wasn't a fool. He knew I wasn't going to sign on for his team. Not after the way he treated me the last time we'd met. He knew that nothing he said was going to sway me. I might have surprised him with that little nugget of information about Arctis Tor, but that could have been an act too. All in all, odds were high that this conversation was accomplishing absolutely nothing, and Nicodemus had to know that. So why was he having it? I asked myself.
Because the goal of the conversation doesn't have anything to do with the subject or the context of the conversation, I answered.
He wasn't here to talk to me about anything or convince me of anything. He wanted to talk to me and keep me here,
which meant that something else was about to happen somewhere else.
Wheels within wheels.
My God, it was a metaphor. This conversation was a metaphor for the parley as a whole. Nicodemus hadn't come to talk to us about violations of the Accords. He'd engineered the parley, and his motivation had nothing to do with subverting Marcone's talents to the service of a fallen angel. He was after bigger game. I whipped my staff toward Nicodemus, slamming my will through it in a surge of panicked realization, screaming,
Fusari!
As I did, unseen force lifted him from his feet and slammed him into one of the huge Corinthian columns like a cannonball. Stone shattered with a deafening crash like thunder, and a lot of rock started to fall. I didn't stick around to see how much. It wouldn't kill him. I only hoped it would slow him down enough for me to get to the others.
Kincaid!
I shouted as I ran. My voice boomed through the empty halls in the wake of the collapsing rubble.
Kincaid!
I knew I had only seconds before all hell broke loose.
Kincaid! Get the kid out of here!
I screamed.
They're coming for Ivy!
Chapter 30. My brain flew along a lot faster than my feet. Given the heavy snow outside, the first line of retreat the archive would take would be into the Never Never. The spirit world touches on the mortal world at all places and at all times. It gets weird once you realize that totally alien regions of the Never Never might touch upon relatively close points in the real world. Crossing into the Never Never is dangerous unless you know exactly where you're going. I don't use it as a fallback very often at all, but if you've really got your back to the wall,
and you have more experience than me at crossing over, you can get a feel for the crossing, and almost always get to someplace relatively benign. I figured it was safe to assume that the Archive would be savvy enough to feel comfortable stepping over. In fact, she would have chosen this location for the parley for precisely that reason. The Denarians would know it too, and they didn't want the Archive to escape their ambush and come back loaded for bear. They would have prepared countermeasures, much as they had for Marcone. No, scratch that. Exactly the way they had for Marcone, I realized. The huge spell that had been used to tear apart the defenses of the Crime Lord's panic room hadn't simply been a way for the Denarians to secure the bait in this scheme. It had been a field test for their means to cut off the magical energy from a large area and access to the Never Never with it, and to imprison something big at the same time. It was a bear trap, custom designed for Ivy. They were going to spring that monstrous pentagram again. Only this time, I was going to be standing inside it when it happened. Fortunately, the shed was a lot squattier and more stable than Marcone's old apartment building had been, though that didn't mean pieces big enough to kill people wouldn't fall when the beam ripped through the walls. And though a lot of stonework was used, there was still the danger of fire. Fire. In an aquarium. Breathe in the irony. But more important, once that pentagram came up, and it was coming now, I could feel it. A faint stirring of power that slid along the edges of my wizard senses like some huge and hungry snake passing by in the darkness, it was going to shut the building off from the rest of the world, magically speaking. That meant that I wasn't going to be able to draw in any power to use to defend myself, any more than I'd be able to breathe if someone plunged my head underwater. Usually, when you work a spell, you reach out into the environment around you and pull in energy. It flows in from everywhere, from the fabric of life in the whole planet. You don't create a hole in the field of energy we call magic. It all pours in together, levels out instantly, all across the world. But the circle about to go up was going to change that. The relatively tiny area inside the shed would contain only so much energy. Granted, it would be a fairly rich spot. There was a lot of life in the building. And it had hosted a lot of visitors, generating a lot of emotions, especially the energy given off by all those children. But even so, it was a sealed box. And given the number of people present who knew how to use magic, the local supply wasn't going to last long. Try to imagine a knife fight in an airtight phone booth. Lots of heavy breathing and exertion, but not for long. One way or the other, not for long. That was their plan, of course. Without magic to draw upon, I was pretty much just a scrappy guy with a gun, whereas Nicodemus was still a nigh-invincible engine of destruction. For a few seconds, my steps slowed. Put that way, it almost sounded a little crazy of me to be rushing into this. I mean, I was basically opting for a cage match with a collection of demons, and one that I would have to win within a matter of seconds or not at all. And I hadn't been all that impressive against the Denarians when I'd had relatively few constraints on what power I could wield against them. I did some mental math. If the symbol the Denarians were using was approximately the same size as the one at Marcone's place, it would be big enough to encompass only the Oceanarium itself in the pentagram at its center. Murphy and the others, if they had stayed where we'd come in, would probably be safe. More to the point, if they'd stayed where they were, they would have no way to enter the Oceanarium. That meant that it would just be me and Ivy and maybe Kincaid against Nicodemus, Tessa, and every Denarian they could beg, borrow, or steal. Those were long odds. Really, really long odds. Ridiculously long odds, really. When you have to measure them in astronomical units, it probably isn't a good bet. So, going in there would be bad. If I didn't go in, though, it would be just Ivy and Kincaid against all of them. In a deadly business, Kincaid was one of the deadliest, at the top of the field for centuries, but there was only one of him. Ivy had vast knowledge to draw upon, of course, but once she'd been cut off and expended whatever magic she had immediately available to her, the only thing she'd be able to do with all of that knowledge would be to calculate her worsening odds of escape. Every hair on my body tried to stand up all at the same time. And I knew that the symbol was being energized. In seconds, it would howl to life. I guess in the end, It came down to a single question. Whether or not I was the kind of man who walks away when he knows a little kid is in danger. I've been down this road before. Not going in there would be worse. Heat shimmers filled the air in the hall in front of me as I sprinted toward the ocean.